Thanks for listening to A Little More Conversation. I'm Ben O'Hara-Byrne. On this Monday night, after a passenger threw open the emergency exit on a domestic flight as it came in to land in Korea last week, we speak to an aviation safety expert and former pilot all about it. What kind of chaos does that create in the cockpit? Just how dangerous is it? And why can't it happen mid-flight? Author Steph Catterdell joins me to talk about her just-released memoir called Everything All at Once. The Montreal-based author has written a book about a story of loss, love, and endurance, and how, having lost her father to lung cancer as an adolescent, just a few decades later, she tells him how her husband is diagnosed with an aggressive form of lung cancer, how he survives, and how it made her story of grief, loss, and love complete. A longtime member of Canada's intelligence services joins me to say why he thinks David Johnson's report on foreign interference in our electoral system places too little blame on the government and that intelligence services are owed an apology. But first, it's election night in Alberta. We get analysis and reaction, including how the outcome there will have an impact well outside the province's borders. It is, of course, election night in Alberta. That's going to be the big story through the evening. Now, oftentimes when it comes to provincial elections, this is a national show. If you don't live in the province, maybe it's not such a big deal. We kind of didn't pay a ton of attention when the Quebec provincial election was going on or when Ontario went to vote, mainly because the conclusion was a foregone conclusion. We thought who was going to win. It was very clear that Doug Ford was going to win, very clear that François Legault and Coalition Avenir Quebec were going to win. This is a different story tonight. This is a fascinating election because it is going to be a close one. Just how close, we don't know, but the polls are closed as far as we know. They're meant to close about 5 minutes ago. Some of them, of course, still stay open to make sure everyone who's in line gets to cast their ballot, but technically, 8 o'clock Mountain, 7 o'clock Pacific, 10 o'clock in the East was when the polls closed in Alberta. So they should start counting the ballots soon. And we should know by the end of the night or maybe early into Tuesday, whether it is Danielle Smith in the United Conservative Party continuing on in power or Rachel Notley in the NDP returning to power. And it's going to really shape it's going to change whomever wins. It's going to change the way the province is run, clearly. And it's also being watched by outside of the province because, of course, in BC, NDP government, right? In other parts of the country, you have more conservative leaning governments. And back in Ottawa, you have a new, more populist conservative leader, opposition leader, who carries a lot of the same messages as Danielle Smith in some ways, some of the same approach. And of course, I imagine the conservatives will be watching closely to see just how well she does tonight, because a lot of this has been about leadership. To give you an idea, coming in, or 4 years ago at least, the UCP really did wipe the table 4 years ago when Jason Kenney was leader with 63 seats, nearly 55% of the vote. The NDP reduced to just 24 seats after having been in power. Of course, Jason Kenney didn't survive his term. That's how fractious the United Conservative Party can be. He was ousted, or at least he announced his resignation almost a year ago now, and Danielle Smith has been his replacement for the past 6 months. So in some ways, she has been in politics quite a while, but this is new for her as well. So it's been a strange campaign because you have Danielle Smith running for basically as the incumbent, even though she isn't really running against someone else, trying to hold someone else to account for their own record, which is the NDP, who'd been in power, 5 years ago. So it's been an odd campaign. It's going to be a big night in Calgary. That's where everyone's going to be watching very closely. That's where the leaders spent their final weekend. That's always a bit of a giveaway as to where they think they need votes. So battleground Calgary in this election is where everyone thinks it's really going to be decided. And here's what Danielle Smith and Rachel Notley had to say over the weekend as they campaigned in that city.
We focused on the things that I believe Albertans really care about, the things that really matter. They didn't. They focused on character assassination, and they didn't run on their record, and they didn't really run on what they were going to do differently. And I think that people see through that. They want to know that there's going to be a positive future.
It is time to come together as Albertans, going beyond party colors, coming together as people who want to see better for themselves, for their families, for their province, a better future for all of them.
Interesting there to hear Danielle Smith talking about the NDP not running on their record when they, in fact, are the opposition party, right? It's been an interesting one. Joining me now with more on this is Fyodor Snevgosky. He's an assistant professor of political science at the University of Alberta. Thank you so much for your time tonight.
Hey there.
This has been an interesting one. I gather we're waiting now. We're in that time of the election night where you basically just kick
the
back
night
and wait for
Christmas. It's just the moment before you unwrap the presents.
Exactly. So I guess the gift tonight is in Calgary, right? That's where all leaders are looking. Is that too simplistic in terms of where you think this election will be decided this evening?
No, I think that's right on the money. I think there's a good chance that I'm calling you from Edmonton. I think the elections in the city are going to be reasonably boring. I think they're mostly going to go NDP, if not exclusively, all 20 seats going NDP. Outside of the province, they're going to be outside of the two major cities, Alberta. Wow, I am all over the place. But outside of Calgary and Edmonton,
sure.
There's going to be some ridings to watch, like in Lethbridge, like in Red Deer. But largely, it's going to be in Calgary. You have most of the province already decided one way or the other. Outside of the two major cities, there's a lot more UCP support than NDP support. In Edmonton, as I said, mostly NDP support. Most of the flexible middle, most of the persuadable voters are in Calgary.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting. And they spent a lot of time campaigning there, right? That's always the giveaway. Near the end, everyone ends up there campaigning. But in terms of the message that they're delivering, now, for listeners outside of Alberta, and I think Alberta's running with their own election coverage tonight, Calgary's a much changed city in the last 10 years in many ways. Those of us who sort of see it as the Calgary of 2004, it's not that city anymore. So explain a bit for listeners outside of Alberta, what's changed there and why this has become such a dynamic place in this election?
Well, basically, 20 years ago, if you had told someone that the NDP would win government, whether they lived in Calgary or elsewhere, particularly in Calgary, they would have laughed you out of the room. They would have said that's just blatantly impossible. You drove around 20 years ago in Calgary, you'd be hard-pressed to find any NDP lawn signs. You'd probably only see PC ones. So in that sense, the city has changed dramatically. Right now, even the public opinion polls that have the NDP down overall have the NDP doing much better in Calgary than they did in 2015 when they actually won government. So NDP support has grown considerably in Alberta's largest city. I think a lot of that is to do with the changing population. So we have, a younger population coming in and replacing older voters, which is sort of a polite way of saying older voters are, exiting the electorate, and more younger voters, more millennials are coming in, and those issues start to matter more. We know that visible minority Canadians tend to vote more for the NDP than the UCP, and the growth of racialized communities has encouraged that as well. Alberta is becoming a more educated province, so I think there's a lot of demographic things that push in the NDP's direction.
One of the things that's been striking about Danielle Smith, if you're not in Alberta, is certainly early on when she was talking about, the unvaccinated as being the most discriminated against group that she had ever known, and sort of really playing up the whole idea of the mandates and so on. Is there going to be any link? Do you think that's going to have any impact on this election? I was reading somewhere that, 98% of people who are unvaccinated will be voting UCP. It's going to be interesting that lies in the background, considering, many people have moved beyond those times at this point in time.
Yeah, and it's something else that was happening around the same time as the convoy, right? So
right.
Those were the debates that we were having on the national stage and Coutts. That was sort of the group she was appealing to. And I think probably Danielle Smith believes some of this stuff, but there's a certain concerted effort to win the leadership. And she knew that, going up against someone like Travis Toews, she had to appeal to the right of center. So, she started appealing more to that group. And then when she won leader, when she said that, the unvaccinated were the most discriminated against group. I wonder if she just sort of forgot that it's now a general that she needs to be pivoting to rather than speaking just to the base. But, that said, a lot of conservative leaders in this province don't last that long. They're often deposed by their internal party revolts. And the Take Back Alberta crowd, for listeners outside of Alberta, that's sort of a far-right fringe part of Alberta's conservative movement, boasts that they had a big role in ousting Jason Kenney and electing Danielle Smith. So she knows that she's got to keep them on side. So I don't expect, it was sort of foolish to expect a complete centrist pivot from her in that regard.
Tough It's a tough line to walk, though, when you're in a general election against a more competitive NDP. I mean, for a long time, as long as the Conservative Party of the day was united, I mean, they were essentially unbeatable in Alberta, and that's no longer the case. I mean, given Alberta's economy right now and the way things are working, there's no way this should be a close election. I mean, it just shouldn't be. You'd think that the incumbent would be sort of coasting to victory the way Doug Ford and François Legault did, right?
Absolutely. And, you know, you asked earlier on whether Danielle Smith has affected this election, whether sort of her past scandals and missteps have affected how voters have cast their ballots. And I think, you know, of course, 100% that is true, and it already has, because all of the polling shows that if anybody else was at the helm of the UCP, that it wouldn't be a close election, that the UCP would cruise to victory. And instead, you have a situation where lots of former PC ministers and prominent conservatives have endorsed the NDP for this election. They haven't said that they're going to take out a membership and become lifelong NDPers, but they're quote-unquote lending their votes to the NDP for this election because they perceive Danielle Smith as being too extreme, too far outside of the mainstream. And when you look at some of her statements on, you know, for example, you know, the Alberta Sovereignty Act or CPP, right, and the Provincial Police Force, when you think about some of the comments she's made about the unvaccinated and about, you know, Remembrance Day being ruined because of all these mandates, you know, I think people rightly look and say, maybe this is not someone we want, you know, if we care about democracy.
Well, the results are starting to trickle in from Alberta. The UCP have a very early lead, very early, very, very early. It's, I think, 3 seats right now so far. Just a few polls reporting at this point in time. Fyodor Snegovsky is with us. He's an assistant professor of political science at the University of Alberta. If we're outside of Alberta, there's some interesting storylines going on here, because part of Danielle Smith's appeal, but also part of her weakness, is something that I think Pierre Poilievre also sometimes can exhibit. It's going to be, I think, a lot of conservatives are going to be watching tonight to see how Danielle Smith does, given that she can be quite a polarizing figure. And obviously, in a lot of other places like BC, where there's an NDP government, the Liberals will be watching to see how Rachel Notley does tonight, because she, you know, she's a partner that they like to work with as well.
Absolutely. And if you're tuning in from the rest of Canada, hi. Nice to have you here, but there are two sort of big things that you should be paying attention to as a result of this election. The first is exactly what you said in terms of Pierre Poilievre. You know, the conventional wisdom here is that Alberta or the Canada is about 7 to 10 years behind the United States in terms of some of the central themes that come up in campaigns. So I think, you know, this was the first sort of taste of more culture-based, grievance-based campaigning. You saw that with some of the, you know, comments early on about, you know, drag queens performing in schools and the candidate that compared trans kids to poop in cookie batter.
Right.
You know, really reprehensible stuff that we're sort of almost desensitized to in the United States, but we haven't really seen in Canada. I think people like Pierre Poilievre are paying very close attention to see whether the sort of culture war type stuff ends up making a difference, whether it's good campaigning. Now, I think any reading of this campaign should be that that kind of stuff does not work very well. Even if Danielle Smith wins, every poll has shown that the UCP would have won in a landslide. Even if they win with a comfortable margin tonight, he would have probably done a lot better had someone else been at the helm. Someone's probably focusing on a more traditional message. And this is Alberta, right? I mean, this is where the Conservatives should be the strongest. So if it's not working here, why would it work anywhere else? The second thing people outside of Alberta should be thinking about is climate change. So, you know, maybe they would have seen throughout the news that there's a really bad situation over here right now with wildfires. And that was going on all throughout the campaign. You know, people were fleeing active wildfires. They were fearing for their lives, their property, their livestock. And even if you weren't in imminent risk of, you know, being overrun by wildfires, you probably lived in a city that where the air quality was horrible, where you couldn't go outside for large stretches of time, for days at a time, without wearing, you know, an N95 mask, basically,
right,
because the smoke was so thick. And in a province like that, the fact that we haven't really talked about climate change during this election campaign, and didn't come up at all during the debate, I think, you know, should give people pause about the direction the province is going, whoever wins. And given that Alberta is going to be central to solving, to addressing the problems of climate change in Canada, I think, you know, that should be something everyone is paying attention to.
Yeah, it was interesting that it didn't come up at all, specifically from the NDP during. But I gather because of the wildfires, there was this idea taken that this was not going to be in an emergency. This was not the time to bring up a debate that can be divisive, at least within domestic politics. As a last quick question, any particular places you're really looking to tonight? Any particular ridings that you think are really going to tell the tale? I gather most of them are sort of along one dividing line in Calgary.
Yeah, I think that's basically it. So, you know, you have the ridings near the Bow River that are sort of going to be the most closely watched. I think one that I'm sort of paying very close attention to throughout the night is Calgary-Glenmore. You know, that's sort of you know, been thrown around by a number of people independently as sort of a bellwether riding. But I think, you know, this is one of those elections that could be so close that every vote matters, every seat matters, and you know, I think it's probably not that likely that we're going to know the outcome of every election by the end of the night. I think
right.
People have a good sense of, you know, who's going to be in government, but there are going to be people who don't know who their MLA is come tomorrow morning.
Right. Memories of Christy Clark in the 2016 election in BC that wasn't decided for quite a while. Fyodor Stanevgoski, exactly. Thank you so much. Thanks so much for your time tonight.
Thanks.
Let's head to Ottawa now. An NDP MP has now received a briefing by Canada's spy agency, who's told her that she's an ongoing target of foreign interference by China. Jenny Kwan says she's being targeted because of her advocacy for immigrants, the diaspora community, and human rights.
It is more clear to me than ever that I will not be intimidated, that I will not be silenced in any way. Whoever is trying to put pressure on me in whatever way that they're trying to do it, they will not succeed.
Jenny Kwan there, the Vancouver area NDP MP. Both, of course, the NDP and all other opposition parties continue to call for a public inquiry on foreign interference. The Johnston Report released last week, of course, recommended against it. But now the NDP has tabled a motion calling for Johnston to step aside as special rapporteur investigating foreign interference in Canadian affairs. That's what Jagmeet Singh had to say today. That, of course, comes after they've been under a lot of pressure to try to up the ante on the Liberals and saying, listen, if you don't have a public inquiry, we're going to end our agreement that's allowed whereby the NDP have been supporting the minority Liberal government. They haven't gone that far yet, but they're going to file this motion tomorrow for the special rapporteur today. It'll be discussed tomorrow in Parliament to see if, you know, to see if David Johnston will hang on even after this. The pressure really is on him to step aside at this point. Meantime, those who work in the intelligence community have taken some offense to David Johnston's report, particularly in the way that it lays so much of the blame for the lack of communication between the intelligence services and the bureaucrats and the politicians on the intelligence services themselves. And those who've been studying this or know this community really well say that successive governments, not just this one, but ones before it as well, of different political stripes, have been ignoring intelligence on foreign interference for years. And it is not necessarily the fault of the intelligence services that this is happening. Phil Gursky is president and CEO of Borealis Threat and Risk Consulting in Ottawa. He spent more than three decades with CSIS and the CSE, and he joins me now. Phil, thanks for your time.
Always a pleasure, Ben. Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
This is interesting because you're uniquely positioned. I mean, there are others out there too, but you're uniquely positioned to take us behind the curtains of how intelligence is gathered and disseminated. And I gather from what you've read in the Johnston report, you're not entirely convinced he's got it right here. Why is that?
Well, I think it's a number of reasons, to be honest, Ben. I think his exposure to intelligence was probably negligible when he was Governor General. I don't recall the GG being a big client of ours at CSE or CSIS. Secondly, the report was constrained by time period, so we only had so much time to talk to the CSIS director as well as the chief of CSE. And thirdly, and perhaps most ominously, he's writing a report on behalf of a government that doesn't get intelligence, get in the sense of understand it, appreciate it, and know how to use it. And that become crystal clear in the Trudeau government's response to these Chinese interference allegations. And I think the report simply reiterates what a lot of Canadians know, is that intelligence is simply not valued by this government, and I'm sorry to say, by previous governments as well.
Yeah, we've been ignoring this issue, it feels like, for a very long time. One of the things that stood out here, I think, from that report is, coming off the pages, you sense that a lot of the responsibility for this lack of communication or these communication breakdowns was being laid at the feet of the intelligence agencies, not of the government. In other words, they didn't know what they weren't getting. But you disagreed with that.
100%. You know, I didn't work in liaison per se, Ben, but I certainly worked alongside a lot of people. I was one of the producers of the reports, both at CSC and CSIS, that would have been forwarded to clients at very senior levels in the Canadian government. So I know how the sausage is made, as they say. And I know that we both organizations have dedicated liaison people who inhabit the very buildings where these senior officials work. And they hand deliver intelligence, and they wait for feedback, and they'll provide feedback toward the organizations for better intelligence. So CSIS and CSE are doing their jobs. They are not sitting on the intelligence. It's just wrong, put it that way. And the problem is that once you deliver the intelligence, you can't make people act on it, and you can't make people pass it on. So when Mr. Johnson blamed the security services for lack of distribution, he was completely wrong, because it's the officials on the receiving end who decide who up the food chain have to see it. And if they decide that people such as the PM shouldn't see it, then that's on their shoulders, not on CSIS and CSE shoulders.
So it feels like he's missing a piece of the puzzle here. I mean, it's, some of the terms that he used were terms like, it's rare for specific names to be mentioned. So specifically who at those departments received these memos cannot be determined. So there's kind of a lack of a paper trail, he says. He described a cloudy picture of how intelligence is shared. And yet, break it down for us. How is it shared? Because one would assume that if they got actionable intelligence, that an MP, say Michael Chong, for example, was somehow being talked about by Chinese diplomats in this country in a way that was not, that was cause for alarm, that would be flagged somehow. But he says that it wasn't. And it's odd to figure out where the breakdown is, given what he's talking about.
Well, one of the reasons, Ben, why specific people aren't named on the distribution side is because, you know as well as I do, cabinet shuffles happen 9 times a minute.
Right.
And that we also want to ensure that other people in the department, not just the minister or deputy minister, are on the receiving end. So we want the distribution to be as wide as possible. That's why we say, you know, Minister of Public Safety's office, because there's more than one person. There's only one minister, but there's a whole bunch of DMs and ADMs, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. The best job is done to identify people who should be on the receiving end, because we know the intelligence is important. We know it's accurate. We know it can make a difference in decision-making, not the difference necessarily, but a difference in making better policies and decisions. And as a consequence, very careful work is done by professionals at the variety of organizations like CSE and CSIS to not just identify the offices that should be on the distribution list, but to make sure that they do get it. And as a consequence, I don't understand the criticisms in Mr. Johnson's report. It seems to be nitpicking to me. You don't have to put the prime minister's name on to make sure, or hope rather, that a matter of this importance, interference in our federal elections on two occasions, would be brought up to his attention. And yet it wasn't done.
Well, barely, as far, at least that's what they told him. Right? I mean, that's part of the other
that's
part
the story,
of the problem
yeah.
with this is that, you know, Johnson is taking a certain version of events that mayor, I mean, I'm not to say that they're purposely misleading him, but, you know, people see things the way they see things, right? This idea that the public safety minister wouldn't have had access to an email and therefore warnings about the Michael Chong situation would have been missed. I spent enough time working around and in, you know, around government and then briefly in an environment where you had to deal with government to know that just could, I don't think that could happen.
That's not incredible. I'm sorry. I spent 32 years in government. And yes, you know, the minister may be traveling or busy, but something of this import, Ben, where you've got a sitting MP whom the service has identified as working for a foreign power that is not an ally of Canada and has been shown over many decades to be interfering not in our, just in our democracy, but threatening Canadian citizens like Uyghurs and Tibetans, dissidents of the PRC regime. That this information would not be sent to this Minister of Public Safety. And if we did not get a response, that we'd send more than one email, maybe even a phone call, maybe even a knock on the door, say, Mr. Minister, we need to see you. We need to see you right now. So this allegation that, you know, it went to an email box that wasn't seen, it doesn't fly with me, Ben. I've worked with many people, very good professionals, whose lives were basically getting the intelligence in the hands of people that needed to see it to make better decisions. And so this feeble excuse by the minister and others in the Trudeau administration strikes me as completely non-credible.
The problem, of course, is that a lot of that information will never be seen by any of us. So you have to believe those writing the reports, right? Because you don't have anything to base another view on, except for, you know, from people like yourselves who know what it works like behind the scenes. But for the rest of us, we're kind of left having to say, well, you know, David Johnson's saying, trust me, I'm a smart guy. I looked into this and here's what I came up with. We don't have much evidence to prove that he didn't get it right.
Well, we're into a he said, she said, Ben, at this point. I don't want to remind your listeners, but when's the last time a politician who said, trust me, was high on the list of Canadians' credibility? I won't go there. But as somebody who wrote reports for CSIS and CSC, it was my responsibility in part to help identify clients. Now, I wouldn't, you know, have the end all and be all decision, but I knew who should see the information that I was producing. And so I would suggest, you know, the following people, the following allies outside of Canada would be on the distribution, like our Five Eyes partners, for example. Right. I would have a say in whom I thought. And then, of course, others, my superiors would weigh in and say, yes, you're right. We'll send it to so-and-so, but also so-and-so and so-and-so.
Right.
There's no way that this was not done, Ben. I'm sorry. I can't buy the GG's allegations in this regard.
Yeah. And in that case, you're also determining, I mean, you have a much broader view of this too. You don't live in a vacuum, right? You're also understanding what the broader geopolitical scene is and why, for instance, the Minister of Public Safety may have to see something at a time when maybe it would go to defense instead. Like you understand where all the puzzle pieces are.
Well, exactly. And the thing is, we meet with clients. In fact, you know, one part of what's called the intelligence cycle, Ben, is you get requirements. Well, who do you get requirements from? Well, from your customers and clients. They tell right. you what they want to see. And then you feed that, what we call a requirement, into the system, into the collection system. You try to find the raw intelligence that meets the requirement. You collect it, you process it, you analyze it, you translate it. Maybe you decrypt it. In the old days, we used to decrypt things. I'm not sure we do that anymore. You write it up in a nice 2 to 3 page package. These are 30 page reports, Ben. They're very, very short because you know people are very busy. And we hand it to them on a silver platter and say, we have the information that you asked for, and here it is for you. So Canadians can be faulted for not understanding the intelligence cycle. I mean, obviously, those like me who worked in it, you know, obviously we get it. But this is one of the reasons why I wrote the op-ed was to try to educate Canadians and maybe the Governor General as to how this system works right from the get-go.
Phil Gursky is with us this half hour. He's president and CEO of Borealis Threat and Risk Consulting. He spent more than 3 decades with CSIS and the CSE. If David Johnson's report doesn't quite get this right, it feels like, how do you fix something if you've diagnosed it incorrectly? But what needs to be done now? Do you think a public inquiry would help here?
You know, Ben, when I hear public inquiry in Canada, I think we have like 9 a week, don't we? Or royal
we
commissions?
We
it's
do.
Kind of like a national yeah. sport in our country. It's kind it of is. After ice hockey, I think it's a national sport. How many we had historically? What difference have they made? Yeah, reports come out, recommendations are made. Does anyone follow up on what actually happened? So I don't really know that public inquiry is required. I will point out as well that not just CSIS and CSE took a lot of criticism. You guys in the media did as well for reporting the issue, which you should have reported, by the way. I think what has to happen now are two things. First of all, governments have to improve what I call their intelligence culture. We have a very poor culture here in Canada. They don't understand intelligence, don't think it's valuable, et cetera, et cetera. And I think we hold our feet to the fire. This issue is not going away. China's got a free pass, as far as I'm concerned, on what they've done. They've seen us dawdle and kick the can down the road on this issue, and they're going to keep doing it. So CSIS will keep investigating and keep providing intelligence. So I think pressure from you guys in the media, more intelligence along the same lines that CSIS has been providing for 3 or 4 decades on this issue, might get someone to move. But you know, Ben, I'm a glass half full kind of guy most of the time, but I don't know that Canadian politicians will ever understand the value of intelligence and use it for the purposes for which we collect and we provide it in the first place.
And you feel this has been systemic. This is not about the Liberals under Justin Trudeau. It's about successive governments not paying enough attention to it. Why is that? Because it feels like in other countries, and they get it wrong too, let's be honest, but it feels like in places like Britain or the US, clearly, that intelligence is pretty well respected and pretty well understood.
It is. And we're not so arrogant as to say that we never get it wrong. You know, there are times in which the intelligence isn't properly corroborated or sourced. Hey, guess what? People lie. Sources lie. And you can report something that simply isn't true. But you're talking about organizations. CSE has been around since, you know, after the Second World War. CSIS, you know, since 84, before the security service, et cetera, et cetera. We're talking about professional organizations that have been around the horn a few times. We work closely with our allies, not just the Five Eyes, but around the world. And I would say, clearly I'm biased. 3 decades makes you biased, Ben. I'm not claiming any kind of neutrality here. But I think they're very good organizations and very professional, and they know exactly what they're doing. Why don't we get it in Canada? I wish I knew, Ben. During the Second World War, intelligence was critical to Canada's military effort against the Nazis and the Japanese. I wasn't alive back then, but from what I've read, that's true.
Yes.
So why intelligence isn't given the same kind of importance and recognition today? I wish I had an answer, Ben. If I had that answer, I'd probably be a bazillionaire at this point. Or maybe not.
Someone would want to hear it. And you took some objections. I mean, I think there's been a lot of talk about the leaks that have been coming from somewhere to various news organizations that have prompted all of this. You took some objection, too, to the way that the former governor general was pretty harsh on this. You thought there could be a lot of different motives, that it wasn't necessarily malicious, that something that the frustration might be a better explanation here.
First and foremost, we don't know who made the leak. The assumption is it was somebody at CSIS. And yet, as I wrote in other op-ed pieces in the Ottawa Citizen, it could have been a client. It could have been a customer. Once the intelligence leaves your hands, anybody can pick it up and decide to send it to the Globe and Mail or whatever kind of thing. Secondly, David Johnson really stressed that this leak, which, by the way, as an aside, I don't support leaking intelligence because I didn't leak intelligence for 32 years. I don't leak it now. You know, when I talk to guys like you, I'm very careful about what I say. Obviously, I don't report things that are very sensitive, but I do talk about intelligence because, nobody else is, so somebody has to talk about it. But this individual, whoever they are, my sense is that they're obviously close to the action. They have access to the intelligence, and they have seen how this intelligence has been ignored, leading to Chinese basically having a free-for-all in our elections in 2019 and 2021, and perhaps before that as well, and saying, enough's enough. The only way that maybe the government will pay some attention is for me to leak this information to the media. That's not malicious. That's somebody who's trying to do a good job, is seeing that job being ignored, being set aside. And they said, I guess I have no choice now. We have to bring this conversation into the greater public domain. And maybe then we'll get some pressure on the government to act. That's what I think the motivation was. I don't think it was malicious at all.
And yet, at least, I guess, here we have a Johnston report. People have been debating about, his neutrality, the validity of the report. But at least now it feels like we're all talking about it. It feels like it was high time that we did, and here we are. It's not perfect. It's been very politicized, which is unfortunate, but here we are talking about it at last.
Hate to tell you, Ben, 2 weeks, 2 months from now, it'll be, how about them Blue Jays? And we're going to forget about this. I've seen it before. I think it's important what we're doing. What we're doing here, you and I, what others in the media are doing, I think is really critical to keep this issue on the top of the agenda, but nothing stays on page one forever. And as a consequence, I think it's just going to kind of fritter away, and we'll just move on. And then China will learn, hey, there's no consequences for us mucking about in Canada's democracy.
You're a glass half full kind of guy, but not on this one. Phil Gursky, thank you so much, as always.
My pleasure, Ben. Thanks for having me on.
As I was saying off the top of the show, normally when it comes to provincial elections, we don't necessarily pay a lot of attention because you're right across the country tonight, right? So if you're sitting at home in Hamilton, do you really care who's the premier of Alberta tomorrow, right? Probably not as much, but we like a good close election on this show, and this promises to be a close one, we think. So right now, votes are trickling in. I mean, it has been molasses slow in Calgary, for instance, where pretty much this election is probably going to be won or lost. So right now, 45-29 is how it's breaking down. But there are some ridings where they're like one poll reporting. So we don't really know what to make of those numbers yet. 44 is your magic number. 87 seats, both in Alberta and in BC, 87 seats. So 44 is the magic number for majority. Right now, 45-29 in favor of the United Conservative Party. So they're there above the threshold. But in many of those ridings, I mean, we're talking about, handfuls of votes having been counted. Not quite sure what the delay is. To give you an idea what a close election looks like, you may remember back to 2016 in BC, where the Conservatives won the election, or the BC Liberals, rather, won the election and ended up only holding on to power for a little while because the Greens and the NDP got together, formed a coalition, and that was it. That was it. So you can see that these elections can be very, very close, and it can come down to just a matter of seats, a matter of votes. That one all kind of boiled down to one seat on Vancouver Island, where the Conservative candidate, who was a third-party candidate, sort of muddied the waters a bit. The Liberal candidate who was favored lost. The NDP candidate won, and that was it. That was the election. Essentially, I mean, the BC Liberals held on to power for a little bit, but not for long, because John Horgan was able to cobble together a coalition with the Greens. He took power, and the rest is history. They've been in power ever since. Dave Breckenridge is with us right now. Of course, he's the editor of the Edmonton Sun and Edmonton Journal, host of the 10-3 podcast. Dave, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
This has been very slow to watch. From, you know, if we try to time these shows, like, I wonder if we'll have results by 8. Well, we have some, but not many. What's going
on? I mean, it was funny because in the conversation with one of your producers about coming on the show tonight and weighing what kind of night I'm going to have, and B, when I thought I would have results in to talk about with you, I thought, well, 9 o'clock my time, we may have quite a few results in. And to put it in perspective right now, 700-some-odd thousand people voted in advanced polling. And so far they've counted just 14,000 votes of the advanced polls. So they've counted 2% of the advanced polls. And and they've only counted 2,800 votes that were cast today, or at least they posted. I'm sure they're counting in the background. But in terms of results they've posted to the Elections Alberta website, it is like molasses on a cold winter's day.
It is. Yeah. Locations reporting today, 27 of 1,217. So there's a long way to go. I mean, it's going to be an interesting night no matter what, because you know, clearly Calgary is going to be interesting to watch. And both sides are talking their game. Now, I mean, this is really a two-party race. I imagine there may be some third-party impact here in some of those ridings. Maybe I was talking about what happened in BC 7-8 years ago and how a third-party candidate really came in and scuttled everything for the BC Liberals in one riding. I mean, that's what elections are close. That's what can happen.
Yeah, I mean, and it would have to be in one of those ridings where the vote is really close. In 2019, there were a couple of Calgary ridings that were decided by less than a couple hundred votes. And you'd have to see that kind of impact from one party in one of those ridings. At this point, I'm not sure if one of the also-rans are going to do it. As the votes sit right now, the only party with more than 1% of the vote is the Alberta Party with 1.02% of the vote out of the votes tallied right now. Everyone else is below 1%. So it would have to be, and I look at the bulk of these third parties, if you want to call them that, as being mostly to the right of where Daniel Smith and the UCP are, and I don't think they have a lot of cachet in a place like Calgary. I could be wrong, but I don't feel like they're going to have that kind of impact tonight that perhaps has been had by smaller parties in other elections. I mean, the thing I'm mostly curious about is how these it's really frustrating. I've been hitting refresh on my computer constantly through the night. What media and I think unanimously said were going to be the close ridings. We haven't seen any votes come in. I look at, you know, in Edmonton Southwest, where Justice Minister Deputy Premier Casey Maddu, or former Justice Minister, sorry, he's now moved over to one of the Labour jobs portfolios before the election. He was facing a tough contender from a three-term public school trustee. And so far, we've just seen 13 votes counted in advance votes or special ballots. And those are those ridings that the night is going to hinge on for us. And there's a ton of those in Calgary as well, where we're barely seeing any votes trickle in. And so, I mean, it makes it hard to do live TV, live radio. I feel for you and also your colleagues on Global TV. It's fun to talk about, though. You look at some of the way that some of these are breaking down. You know, even in Edmonton, in early voting, the UCP have a lead in a riding that they haven't won in a couple elections. So there may be, in addition to Casey Maddow in Edmonton, you could see another UCP MLA in the legislature, which would be a huge win in a city where the last couple elections it's been pretty much all orange. But again, you know, we're waiting, we're refreshing, we're waiting on these ballots to be counted so we can see how this all shakes out.
Yeah, still at 22,545 ballots. that's not a lot of people. It's interesting to look back at this campaign because, of course, in hindsight, when we know what the results are tomorrow, there'll be lots of people sort of reassessing what went right and what went wrong during the campaign. I was interested to hear the UCP talk about the debate as if it went really well. And I suppose it did, considering Danielle Smith had just been found to have broken ethics rules in the province, which is usually the kiss of death. But she seemed to get through it quite well. I'm surprised they feel that was the turning point. But I guess the debate was. Rarely do they make a big difference in an election, but it seems that this one may have, at least according to the United Conservative Party.
Yeah, and I think there were a couple things for Danielle Smith in the debate, and one of them was just to, based on the fact that there's been a countless number of recordings of her at various stages in her life of punditry, saying things that may fall outside the political mainstream in Alberta. And so she had to present herself as more mainstream than those video clips did, and she also had to potentially reckon with the specter of this ethics commissioner report. But I feel like the one thing that went in her favor in the debate was the fact that the NDP didn't really land a good, a good blow against her when it came to that ethics commissioner report. They really didn't make it about trust. They tried to stick too much, I felt, to their policy, which, I mean, the NDP had to do to sell themselves as, again, being a moderate centrist kind of NDP party as opposed to a far left NDP party, which the UCP would like to paint them as. But I felt because of that, they didn't really focus on the big news of the day, which was the ethics commissioner report. And so that was a loss in my books for the NDP, which made it easier for Danielle Smith to, quote unquote, win the debate. And I know it's hard to say who really wins these things, but in terms of how leaders come off with voters, the UCP strategists that are saying that that's what really did it for them may be right in the end.
Yeah, I watched the parts of the debate. Obviously, I was on air, but I watched bits and pieces of it. I watched it before. Actually, it was over not long after we went to air. I was surprised that I think what happened there is that the NDP went in with a playbook. It obviously, and that's part of the NDP's problem always, is they prepare a lot. They're very well prepared. No one works harder than the NDP generally, I mean, at least in my experience. But that also means that when they should have pivoted on that debate and just gone after this ethics thing from the get-go, and just that's all you talked about the whole time, they didn't. They kind of said, mm-hmm. Oh, we'll talk about policy. And it just kind of, what happened is Notley ended up looking a bit lost and a bit unfocused. And you do not want that against a public speaker as experienced as Danielle Smith.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the one thing that Smith has going for her in terms of the political arena is that natural ability to present an image for people, right? She had experience on global TV for years before she went into politics, the provincial politics the first time around. And then she left provincial politics and then went into radio. And, you get kind of, I obviously don't do radio every day like you do. I stumble over my words. These are skills that are hard to deny in a political debate and in a political campaign. And you're right that, Rachel Notley, who's no slouch, generally speaking, when it comes to things like question period, I've heard her make rousing speeches before, but she fell flat. And so if we were looking at the campaign in the rear view, that might well have been the moment that the NDP kind of started to sag a little bit, despite, being really active in the get out to vote and really active on social media and really active in trying to get their supporters behind them. I'm curious how that will play out in terms of voter turnout and especially the ages of voters.
Well, Dave, at least this allows you a bit of a break to sort of write up your storylines as this is unfolding. But it's been very, very, very slow going. I mean, I remember there's been times of late where the election's been called at like 1 minute after the polls close. Someone will call it, right? And here we are. Yeah. It's been an hour and 20 minutes and no one's called a thing yet.
I remember, that's the funny thing that you mentioned, Dwayne Brett, and remembering the 2008 election. I remember that election as well. And CTV... called it very quickly, and another Calgary political scientist, not Dwayne Brad, I can't remember his name, was like incensed that they called it so quickly, but it ended up being the Ed Stelmach Tories steamrolled the competition to one of the largest majorities we've seen in the province up until that point. This is obviously indicative of a very close election. I mean, we're not sure if there's any glitches going on at Elections Alberta headquarters, but you can see there are some very interesting close races shaping up. Riding to the northwest of Edmonton, Morinville, St. Albert is within a few hundred votes. I saw another one that, sorry, I'm scrolling up. A tight race, yeah, in Calgary, where you have
Calgary,
former
Acadia
health minister. Yeah, Calgary Acadia, former health minister Tyler Shandro, current justice minister. As of right now, only has a 6-vote lead on his NDP challenger. That one was expected to be a tight race. Tyler Shandro had his own set of controversies over the last few years in office. I think, you know, only recently had his reputation burnished a little bit due to the fact that he, in that Ethics Commission report that was looking at Danielle Smith's involvement in whether or not she pressured Crown prosecutors or Justice Ministry officials, he was noted in that report by the Ethics Commissioner as having said no, he will not contact his deputy ministers to discuss the case of Artur Pavlovsky, a controversial pastor who is now actually the leader of the Solidarity Movement of Alberta, which as of right now has whopping 0.27% of the vote. So, I mean, there are some close races shaping up. It's going to be a long night for political watchers and journalists alike. I'm hopeful that we'll have some greater semblance of how this is shaping up in the short term. But, you know, there are a few. I mean, even in Edmonton right now, there's, you know, Edmonton Decor has switched back to the NDP, but Edmonton Castle Downs has, again, early voting so far. The UCP has a very early lead in advanced polls. So I'm really curious to see how some of these are going to shake out. They're obviously ridings in, even in Edmonton, where the UCP kind of haven't written off the city just yet. And we'll see if Edmonton voters feel the same way.
Yeah, there's a lot of shaking out still to do. Just to give listeners an idea, you know, a riding like Calgary-Beddington, 1 vote. There's 1 vote for the UCP, so that's it. Calgary-Currie, 2 votes for the UCP, 2 votes for the NDP. Calgary-East, 2-1. Like, that's how slow it's going tonight. Quickly, I have about a minute here. Outside the province, I guess everyone will be paying attention. I mean, this election could have some meaningful impact on how the Conservative Party approaches the next federal election. If the NDP win, it could certainly play in. You're going to have an NDP government in BC, NDP government in Alberta. Certainly could help or help Justin Trudeau. We'll see.
Yeah, I mean, it is interesting because I know that Rachel Notley was quoted on, I believe, the West Bloc with Mercedes Stevenson on Global as saying that, you know, if she were to win and her relationship with Justin Trudeau would be as it always was, which may not play out well with many people in Alberta who see the prime minister as kind of the antithesis to Alberta values, or, you know, might be out to get the oil patch. And so, you know, if she were to win, maybe there'd be a more conciliatory tone struck with Ottawa, and maybe there might be some collaboration on projects. On the flip side, a Danielle Smith win means a more combative tone with Ottawa, which may actually help out, Pierre Poilievre, and he'd have an ally in fighting against Justin Trudeau.
It's going to be interesting to see how it plays out. Well, it feels like we have a long night ahead. Dave, I'll let you get back to work, and I'm sure we'll talk about this again, but thanks so much for your time.
No problem, Ben. Happy to be here.
Life for each one of us is a journey, right? It's full of unexpected twists and turns. We have all had our tragedies. We've all had our joys. We've all had our successes. We've all had our failures. My next guest knows all of that all too well. She began writing this memoir more than a decade ago. It's the story, or it was the story, of a teenager in Montreal losing her father to cancer and the long-term impact that would have and how it really would play out over the years. But the story was left there because really it wasn't finished yet. Where it was going to go from there, no one knew. She didn't know. Married, mother of three. She'd already had her first child when she was starting to write this book, this memoir. This was about a decade ago. Living in Arizona recently, not that long ago, with her husband, endurance athlete Tommy Rivers Putzi, or Tommy Rivs, or just Rivs, as he is known throughout the book. Because while the story is about him, it's really about her. He's also diagnosed with cancer. And suddenly their world turns completely upside down. And at the height of the COVID pandemic, no less, he begins coughing in a way that is terrifyingly familiar to his wife. It takes many weeks, but he's diagnosed as well with a rare form of lung cancer that put him into a medically induced coma for some 84 days. He spends more than 100 days in hospital. And suddenly a book that was meant to be about the pains and the journey of that dealt with childhood grief or adolescent grief becomes a story about something much bigger and much more complicated, and yet and somehow as a memoir, also much more complete. Steph Catterdale joins me now. Her book is called Everything All at Once. It comes out tomorrow, if I'm not mistaken. She's also a professor in media and peace building, a trained interpersonal mediator, and she joins me now. Steph, thank you and congratulations.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me tonight.
It is indeed tomorrow, right? May 30th? Is that, I was just checking the date. Well, congratulations.
Yeah, that is.
Yeah, it must be. I mean, I was reading, I was watching you take some questions on the book and just what a journey it was that you actually, I think, posted to Facebook. A Facebook memory popped up for you recently, said, starting a book, maybe finished in a decade, and here we are.
I know, and that was surreal. I didn't even realize that I had written that. And then when that popped up in my memory, I was like, wow, it really has been that long that I have been working on this book. And to know that it's coming up tomorrow is very surreal.
Yeah, just the story behind it, because, you know, we interview people on the show who've written memoirs. And one of the things that's interesting, of course, about a memoir versus fiction is that there is no easy way to know when it's done, right? Because it's life. So it's tough to know. And I guess in your case, it was tough to know that it wasn't finished yet, but you felt like it wasn't ready.
Right. And someone actually, a writer once told me, you know, there's a time to write your book and there's a time to live it. And because I was really frustrated that my book didn't feel finished. And she kept telling me, maybe you're still living the story. And my thought was, what more could happen? Like, I don't want anything more to happen to me. And, you know, and lo and behold, what happened, you know, my husband was diagnosed with cancer. And not that I was grateful in any way for that happening. It was, you know, truly a tragic a thing that happened. But I was able to heal through that. So that did give me my ending.
Right. I guess we could talk about Rives, because just so listeners know, he's sort of this almost mythical endurance athlete. I mean, in the kind of shape that you could only, you know, would run 11 miles back, 11 miles each way to work when they were living in Arizona, had run the New York Marathon, you know, just a hot, really, and then all of a sudden, felled very quickly, right? I mean, the way you describe it in the book, it happens very quickly that all of a sudden he's not feeling right. And you start to get a bad feeling because you remember this from being a teenager in the suburbs of Montreal.
Yeah, that same hacking cough that my father had when he had lung cancer just kind of was a reoccurring nightmare in some way. I woke up in the middle of the night and my husband had that same cough. And, you know, at the time it was the height of the COVID pandemic. So we assumed it was COVID. Cancer didn't even cross our minds. He was 35 years old, extremely fit, and, you know, just, yeah, like you said, an endurance athlete. So cancer wasn't even in our minds at the time. But that cough was ominous for sure.
And then his battle, which you then go on to describe. So for listeners to know, the book sort of is sort of tells the story of Rives and his attempt to recover. And he's it's a very tough fight that he has. And then you go back in time to sort of childhood and Montreal and your mom and your father getting sick and your brother too had leukemia. So this has been, and yet throughout the book, and I know I've heard you talk about this, you don't feel like these are hardships, right? You don't want people to feel like you somehow have this magic vision into what it's like to live a hard life. You grew up in love. You've just been dealt a lot of really tough blows.
Yeah. And I'm really grateful you said that, because I don't want it to seem like I'm, you know, just this is my life has been tragic and sad, because the truth is, and this is part of my book, is that love has been woven throughout every aspect of my life, including the tragedies. And, you know, and I'm grateful for that, because I know a lot of people also don't have the luxury of the amount of love that I had. So in that way, I wanted this memoir to kind of be an ode to love and how it saved me and changed me in, you know, the most difficult times of my life.
Yeah. One of the words you used was accepting the duality of grief. And I was interested in that. What do you mean? What, in your mind, what does that entail?
Well, what the kind of one of the epiphanies I had during my husband's illness was, you know, this is a tragic, terrifying, traumatic thing that's happening. And at the same time, there was so much beauty to it. There was so much love wrapped all around it, you know, coming from his nurses and doctors that were going above and beyond, even though they were, you know, already worn out from COVID, and friends showing up. And not only that, but people around the world, strangers we didn't know, sending gifts, sending messages and cards and donations. And truly, it felt like in the midst of this lonely time, I was being held by the love of humanity. And so so there was that was the duality. It was so tragic and so beautiful at the same time. And being able to choose to see the beauty in it amidst all of the chaos and the sadness really saved me during that time.
There's some really touching moments in the book because, of course, you have three daughters. They're all young, a little bit younger than you were when your father got sick. But at the same time, you had this memory of your mom and how she reacted. I mean, she had four kids to take care of, although some, I guess, had gotten older at that point. But she had four kids and your father got sick and she was very stoic, I guess, about it. At least in your eyes, she was very stoic about her loss. And that's part of the book, too, is you're sort of trying to work out the relationship that you have with your children as a mom. With a father who's, you know, suffering through a very, very tough time, and how your mom reacted when your father passed. And it was interesting to see how you worked that out, because that's a really tough one to, it's a tough one to ponder. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, what was one of the most beautiful things about the process and then also writing the book was seeing how little credit I had given my mom when I was a teenager in the impossible task she had in raising four teenagers through grief. And I didn't realize how impossible that was until I was faced with that possibility myself in having to do that for my three children. And it kind of just opened this, it cracked me open to all of the memories I had, that all the ways that she had really shown up for me that I didn't recognize at the time because I was, you know, so angry. And then through that, being able, learning how to better do that for my own children through the ways that she loved me through it. And so it was a beautiful full circle kind of realization that I came to, and a healing one with my own mother as well.
Right. Because at the beginning of the book, you thank your father and your mom.
Yeah. Yes. And I, at the beginning, I say, you know, for dad, because it was you all along, and for mom, because you gave me the space to find him. She never kind of tried to force me into a belief or forced me into healing. She just kind of allowed me to be as reckless as I needed in order to deal with, you know, with losing my father.
Yeah. And there is a moment where, of course, you comfort your girls, right? Which was something that I guess your mother, people are different, right? People handle grief differently. And she hadn't done that then. You did that afterwards. But through that, you also began to understand where your mom had been coming from all those years ago.
Yeah. And I think at the same time, she was able to see in me that I too was the only person in her life that knew what she had been through, because we both had, you know, not only husbands with cancer, but husbands with lung cancer. And so we kind of had this incredible bonding moment or moments over the months of just kind of really seeing each other, probably for the first time, just saying, you know, I know what you've been through and this sucks, you know?
Yeah. Steph, a bit about Arivs, about your husband right now, because he had I think reading through your book, there are periods in there where even just coming off the page, it's clear that you don't think that no one thinks he's going to make it, that nobody thinks he's going to make it. And
yeah,
yet,
that
and,
was,
and
yeah.
yet, and yet, and yet he did.
Yeah. And that is, you know, and that was the medical miracle of it all, really. And no one really could explain how or why he survived. Just the level of chemo that they had to give him while he was on a device called ECMO, which is basically like a last resort care for failing lungs, which a lot of people during COVID had to be on that machine. So mm-hmm. the mortality rate alone for that is 52%. And then that on top of basically stage four lung cancer, it did not look possible that he could survive, but here he is today.
Yeah. I was reading an article about him sort of walking the New York Marathon in 9 hours, just a few, not long after he was kind of back home, or because he had to learn to walk again, right? After all that time down. And then this year, was he not in the Boston Marathon? Did that at about 6 hours. So he's getting stronger. And how's he doing?
Yeah. And that's the other kind of quote unquote miracle about all of this, is that no one had ever defied the odds like he did for this particular cancer and its manifestation. No doctors knew what kind of prognosis he would have moving forward. They knew he would have severe lung damage because being on a ventilator for, he was on a ventilator for almost 4 months, I believe, and ECMO for 3 months. That just categorically destroys the lungs, not to mention the tumors. But he's also the most tenacious person in the world. And that's probably also why he survived. And so he just he walks every single day. He starts to run, you know, he can run about 20 to 30 seconds at a time. And he just gets out and every day makes the effort. And I think that's why he's come so far.
And in this book, I mean, that is, you don't actually go into a lot of detail about afterwards. There's a little epilogue just about how he's doing. So you know that he's okay. But when someone picks up the book, what would you like them to take away from it? Because it is a very personal story. And yet it is a story that many people will understand because we've all experienced loss of some form, not as dramatic perhaps as what happened to your husband, but, you know, and his recovery, but we've all experienced loss and grief in some different way. What would you like people to take away from your book?
Yeah. One of the things I'd love people to take away is that there's no right way to grieve. I think that when we go through grief, we think that there's, you know, it's linear, or that there's certain steps that we're going to take and then the outcome is healing. And what I've come to learn is that healing is an ongoing process, and just to accept ourselves exactly where we're at. And that is something that I had to learn how to do in order to continue healing and not be stagnant. And so I hope that people see through my recklessness and my kind of crazy life that they're okay exactly where they're at, and that, you know, strength isn't perfection, and strength isn't just being stoic, but it's just being broken and still continuing on. And that was a lesson that I had to learn for myself, and I was able to learn it through my husband's illness, ironically. Right.
And through the book, right? I mean, in some senses, it, you wrote, a lot of this sort of appeared on social media at the time, but you wrote in some ways to work that out.
Yeah. And actually, when I started writing on social media, it was more just to update the community of people that had rallied around our family to support mm-hmm. us. I wanted to give them some, you know, form of update. But instead, what happened was I started getting messages from people all over the world saying, I've not been through what you've been through, but I'm experiencing grief in the same way that you are. And just that human connection, even if it was, you know, virtual, it just made me feel so much less lonely in such a lonely time when everyone was quarantining and no one could be together. And so it was just, for me, like a lifeline of connection and healing. And it made me realize just how universal grief is, and also how universal love is. And those two truths are just wrapped around each other always.
Yeah. I was saying earlier, you know, when we speak to people who've written memoirs, it's you know, the question always is always, well, where do you end, right? Because it just, your life goes on. So yeah. Today could have been another chapter in, I suppose today, tomorrow will be another chapter in it because the book gets released. But where would you like to see the, will you continue this story now? Is there more to tell?
You know, I don't know. Even now, I finished writing the book about a year ago, or maybe 8 months ago or so. And even now I look back and I think, wow, I've already learned a lot more than, you know, the conclusions I made in my book. And that's a beautiful thing, just to be open to growth. As far as personal story, I don't know. I mean, maybe a novel's next for me, because I feel like I shared a lot of personal information in this memoir, and maybe it's time to take a break for a while, you know, but who knows?
Was that tough? Because it is intimate about your mom. You talk about your siblings, not as much. You talk about people. I mean, you were raised, your mom was a Mormon. You were raised with that as well. You go into a lot of stuff, and there are other people in there too. It must have been difficult to tell all those stories and to remember all those stories.
Yeah. And I definitely wanted to do everyone justice. I didn't want to throw, you know, anyone under the bus. I didn't want to make, you know, any fictional or false claims about everyone, because everyone in my life, save a couple characters that if you read my book, you'll know, really were just full of love and just loved me through the hardest times of my life. But yeah, it's scary to know that tomorrow, you know, a lot of people are going to be knowing every intimate detail about my life, but I think what's beautiful about that is I think a lot of people will see, I hope a lot of people will see themselves, maybe not in the experiences, but in the feelings that I had around those experiences. So yeah, I hope it's just kind of a journey of acceptance. I know it was for me. So
yeah. And again, to go back to something that you said that was quite poignant, was that you didn't feel like you were here to give advice, but simply to let other people know that you've lived through this and that you understand.
Yeah, because honestly, one of the hardest things for me when my husband was sick, and also after my father passed away, was people wanting to give advice. And I understood where they were coming from. There's this human desire to just kind of try to fix things, but really all we need is someone to see us and say, hey, I see where you're at and you're doing okay. And that's all that you need. And so I hope my book is that for people. They can just read it and say, okay, I'm doing okay, just exactly where I am.
And there were some remarkable moments in there too, where you remember kind deeds by people from unexpected places. And that your memory for those is phenomenal, by the way. Someone who did you a good turn, you know, a cab driver or whomever. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, those, and it, maybe I have a good memory, but also those moments really, really stuck to my core, because it was pure love from strangers who didn't need to be kind to me, and they were. And I think those are some of the greatest acts of love, or just, you know, love for no other reason than wanting to help someone out. And so those moments really, really stuck to me, and I wanted to do those justice in my book. So I'm glad you say that I did.
Well, Steph, thanks so much. Congratulations on the release tomorrow. Everything All at Once is the name of the book, and it gets released tomorrow.
Thank you so much.
The polls all said it would be a close one. It's been slow going for the vote counting tonight, so we haven't had nearly as clear a picture 2 hours after the polls closed as normally you would. Often these days, elections can be called within, you know, a few minutes after the polls close. They often are. Not tonight, though, but it does look like it is breaking the way that a lot of pollsters were predicting. So right now, the UCP, the United Conservative Party, and Danielle Smith are leading or elected in 50 seats. The NDP are leading or elected in 36. A lot of pollsters thought that might be the way it would break. The NDP would make some gains over 2019. The UCP would take some losses, but that ultimately this would all wind up with a UCP majority and that Danielle Smith would be premier again come tomorrow. 44 seats is what you need for a majority. You know, a lot of it was down to Calgary. And tonight, Calgary is kind of breaking the way they thought it would. Again, lots of votes still to be counted, but the NDP have made some gains in Calgary, but not enough, not quite enough. The ECP is still holding on to some key seats in the city as well. Nick Kulsbergen is a former campaign manager for the UCP. And back in 2019, he's the CEO of Wellington Advocacy Now, and he joins me now. Nick, thanks so much for your time tonight.
Absolutely. Good to be with you.
So what's it been like? It's been very slow going. So I thought by now we'd have a lot, we'd have a lot of finality to talk about, but it's starting to take shape, right? It's starting to take shape.
Yeah, I really thought we'd have a result. I think we had a result within, you know, 20 minutes or so last election, but obviously some issues or challenges with Elections Alberta getting numbers in. But I think you covered it off the top, which is the NDP have made some gains, but we're not seeing the tidal wave of NDP support in Calgary, which is really what they need to do to win this election. So, you know, I think it's still early. There's still lots of balance to count. But I think for the UCP side, we started the night feeling cautiously optimistic. I think we're feeling a little bit better than that right now. But still lots of balance in those boxes still.
Yeah, I mean, it's given the state of the economy and so on. Again, I think a lot of people outside the province have looked in and thought, "Wow, that's closer than we expected it to be, right? Closer than this election could be." But there was some. What did you make of the campaign itself? Because I mean, there was obviously the NDP spent a lot of time focusing on Danielle Smith, and the UCP spent a lot of time focusing on Rachel Notley. So it was kind of an interesting election to watch because neither party spent a whole lot of time tooting their own horn, which was interesting and rare, you know, rare, to be honest.
You know, I think from the conservative side, you know, we through COVID, we obviously saw a real drop in support for the UCP. And I think you have to give a lot of credit to Premier Smith for, you know, coming in, winning a leadership race, really consolidating the party base, really. You know, the Wild Rose Independence Party, you know, was polling in sort of the mid-teens, has really come down to zero. And she deserves a lot of credit for that. And that, you know, I think if we would have said, you know, coming out of COVID that the UCP would be sitting here with a very good chance at re-election tonight, I think we'd all be very happy. So, you know, I get from the outside looking in, it's why is Alberta this close? There's a lot of you know, dynamics on the ground that make that what it is. You know, I think from the UCP perspective, they were, you know, really happy to run on their record the last 4 years, and, you know, strong, as you said, really strong economy in Alberta. You know, inflation, big problem across the country, but less, you know, has been managed a little bit better in Alberta. At the end of the day, is Alberta really going to go back to an NDP government when you have a united Conservative Party? I mean, I think in my mind that was always a tough task for the NDP to pull off.
Yeah, I mean, virtually impossible at times, right, for the NDP, for an NDP government to beat a united Conservative government. I guess part of the issue here and was whether or not Danielle Smith represented that united, whether they were going to be as united on the kind of lend me your vote thing. Do you think the NDP focused too much on, I mean, a lot of people just dip in and out of politics, right? They don't pay rapt attention to what's going on. Do you think they in some ways set Danielle Smith up to succeed by sort of making it look, I mean, clearly they were using her own words against her, which was effective, but then come debate time, you know, she's well-spoken. She can carry off she can perform really well in a forum like that. It felt like they put too much emphasis on trying to set the bar too low for her is what I'm trying to say.
I think they definitely did that in the debate. I think, you know, Premier Smith really outperformed expectations in the debate. I also think it's one thing to use someone's words against them when they're sort of an unknown candidate. But Premier Smith has been premier for, 7-8 months now? And, you know, the sky hasn't fallen for, you know, as the NDP have claimed in Alberta. And they also, there's a little bit of a history of jumping the shark, going out and saying that the UCP are going to, you know, sell off hospitals. The reality is when you launch attacks on your opponent, rule number one is they have to be believable, because if you lose credibility on your attacks, people just won't believe it, and they won't believe a lot of the other things that you're saying. So, you know, I think Premier Smith definitely had a great debate, definitely outperformed expectations, and on your point about lending the vote, which you've really seen a focus from the NDP in the last couple of days. Like, the reality is a lot of those people did not support Jason Kenney last time. They didn't support the merger of the party. So, the majority of the Conservatives in Alberta, I think, are pretty strongly behind the UCP. And I think you're seeing that tonight.
When you look outside, I mean, I think you were in BC back when Christy Clark won and then lost that election, which was a really...
Yeah.
So you know how close it can get, because now we're up to 48-39 at this point. So it's whittling back down. You know how tense these nights can be, right? Do both leaders survive tonight if it ends up really close?
I think it's way too early to say that. I mean, I don't know what I can't speak for Rachel Notley. Obviously, I think on Premier Smith, she's absolutely accomplished the objective of getting this party united and back together and put it in a really, really good shape to win the election tonight. So I think Premier Smith 100% stays with a close result here. I'm sure there'll be some people who argue otherwise, but I think she's, the performance in the campaign, her time as premier, the unity that she's brought, I think she's staying for sure.
Yeah, it is narrowing down. Again, there, you know, a lot of votes still to be counted, but right now we're at 48 UCP, 39 NDP, which is sort of within the range, again, of what a lot of pollsters were saying coming in, that the UCP had some momentum and a slight lead. When you look at some of the things, I mean, what's funny is that the campaign, there wasn't a lot about the policy platforms of both parties seemed relatively close, other than on things like taxation, for instance. But there wasn't a whole lot to divide, and there wasn't a lot of talk about stuff. But do you think that it's going to be hard, and we've seen it already, it's hard for Danielle Smith to appeal both to the sort of traditional conservative part of her party and the more sort of newer populist Wildrose part of her party? Is she going to be able to keep this together afterwards? If you're back in power and there isn't a looming election and sort of a known quantity to fight against, you could feel, I mean, it happened to Jason Kenney, you could feel the sort of the divisions. Are they there under the surface as far as you can tell, or is this as united as you think it is?
You know, when the two parties came together, I think, when I was working there at this time, the biggest thing we saw was, when you're facing down your opponent, that was the most unifying part of that really unified the UCP when we merged the PCs and the Wildrose. I think there's certainly a sentiment within conservative circles in Alberta that we probably had enough of this infighting. It certainly has not helped our electoral chances over the last couple of years. So I hope conservatives in Alberta can put those divisions aside and focus on providing good government for 4 years. Coalition management for the United Conservative Party is really coalition management for any conservative party in Alberta is really the story of the last 10 years. And when we are united, we win, and when we're not united, we lose. And I think we saw that was theoretical in 2015. It's not theoretical now. So I hope that memory is enough to keep people together.
Nick, for all those watching outside, there must have been some interest from other parts of the country in how this was shaken down. What kind of questions have you been getting from outside of Alberta about what's happening and what kind of impact it could have on the national scene?
I think our federal Liberals would, I'm sure, love a Rachel Notley win. Having someone that's gonna work with them as opposed to argue against them on things like the carbon tax. They definitely are cheering for Rachel Notley tonight. So certainly got some questions about that. A lot of though, just general like asks for predictions, right? People are confused as about what is happening in Alberta. You know, why there's been a lot of instability and a lot of chaos and a lot of change in the last couple of years. And I think it's just a lot of like, yeah, what does this sort of mean for the rest of the country? I think the national storyline in this election really is, you're going to have either an ally of Justin Trudeau win this election, or you're going to have someone that's going to fight them on the carbon tax and issues like that, just transition, clean fuel standards. That's really, I think, the national implication for this election.
Right. And of course, there's next door. There's BC as well. David Eby's now premier here. And we haven't really heard much. I mean, everybody has been so new. Eby came onto the job right about the same time as Danielle Smith did. It's going to be interesting to see what kind of relationship they have, because when they work well together, it works great. And when they don't, it can be a bit contentious. I actually don't even really know whether Danielle Smith's ever addressed the relationship with British Columbia.
Yeah, I truthfully don't remember seeing it come up either. She's obviously been premier for 8 months and has really been focused on getting ready for this election. You know, the biggest issue for Alberta as relates to BC is getting Alberta oil to Tidewater. And right. I think, things seem to be on track there, although I think, no one's going to really celebrate that until that pipeline is actually flowing oil.
Yeah. Just on terms of narratives, it's going to be interesting to see, because the embracing sort of at least the association with the convoy movement, the association with mandate, with opposing mandates, is something that Danielle Smith has taken with her into politics, and it was seen as being baggage, being defeatist, right? Or it wasn't helping her, wasn't helping her win this election. Pierre Poilievre has similar messages that he delivers as well, with the same calculation that they're not going to hurt him politically. This could change some calculations on for either of them come tomorrow, if in fact Danielle Smith goes on to win tonight.
Yeah, there's a lot of people in Alberta, and I think a lot of people in BC and other parts of the country who were not happy with how governments across the country dealt with COVID. I would say though, I don't, as much as that has been a sort of narrative, certainly a narrative in the leadership race, I don't know that it was really a narrative in the election campaign. The election was really more about, do you want to keep going with the last 4 years? The NDPs, I think the NDP made a mistake in terms of promising, 38% increase in the corporate tax rate, which is really a signature, campaign issue from the last election. So it was issues like that that were in the campaign. And then healthcare capacity was the biggest push from the NDP. So it wasn't so much about those issues, that the COVID issues, the mandates, the convoy. They may have been, sort of ankle biting issues. Parties wanted to talk about it. People, parties' war rooms wanted to talk about it. but it wasn't what the campaigns were really pushing in terms of their main message with voters.
Yeah. And I guess, I mean, there'll be a lot of work to be done to keep everyone happy come tomorrow. I mean, I think, depending on what we see tonight, you're going to have a UCP, if in fact the UCP maintain this lead tonight, which they're doing so far. You're not going to have any representation in Edmonton, or very, very little. Not much in the burbs of Edmonton, and potentially not a ton in Calgary either. So it's going to be hard to, you know, having not a lot of major city representation could be a bit of a challenge for the UCP.
I think you'll still have very strong representation in Calgary if the UCP are successful tonight, and maybe not Edmonton proper, but there's still those donut seats around Edmonton, and I would expect those members would obviously be well represented in the cabinet to make sure that voice is heard. There's still those secondary cities, Grand Prairie, Red Deer. I'm sure you'll see them. They'll represent it as well. Lethbridge will be tight. I haven't seen
Lethbridge
the latest writings on Lethbridge, but Lethbridge should be tight riding tonight. So.
Yeah, I'll have to look again. I keep scrolling and refreshing as we talk. I'm trying not to do that too much. 52-35 at this point for the UCP. Nick, thanks so much for your time tonight.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
I don't know if you saw this story late last week, but someone, a passenger on a flight, a domestic flight inside South Korea, decided to fling open the emergency exit as the plane was coming in to land. And there's some video of it online of sort of just the wind blowing through this cabin as the plane is kind of descending. And I mean, it was talked about a lot, but I was really curious as to how does that work? How can you open an exit door during a flight? Now, this gentleman was formally arrested on Sunday. He faces up to 10 years in prison. He, during preliminary questioning, he said that he felt suffocated and tried to get off the plane quickly. Clearly, he was having some stress issues. He'd had some issues in the past that he talked about a little bit. They're kind of digging into all of this, but clearly was not in the right frame of mind when all this went down. No one was badly hurt, thankfully. That was the big deal. ABC News contributor Steve Gagnard reports the incident occurred, again, as the plane was nearing its destination at an altitude of about 213 meters, so not very high.
The fact that this happened at very low altitude just prior to touchdown means that everybody should have been belted in. Nobody was going to get sucked out of the airplane.
Right. And this got me curious just about emergency exits in general, because this is not the first time we've seen a story about someone trying to open one in flight. Can you imagine being on a plane if someone got up and started trying to open the emergency exit while you were in midair? Well, apparently you can't really open an emergency exit if the plane is at cruising altitude. It just doesn't work. But I wanted to know why that was. Doug Moss runs Aero Pacific Consulting. He's a retired airline pilot and aviation and safety and security program instructor at the University of Southern California. Doug, thank you.
You're welcome. It's my pleasure.
I guess when one reads about these incidents, everyone puts themselves on that plane, right? Because we've all been there and thinking, what would happen if someone tried to open the door, in this case succeeded? But just how scary an incident is it?
The purpose of the emergency exits, their primary purpose is to make sure that anyone, no matter how strong or intelligent they are, can open that door in an emergency,
right?
Not requiring any assistance of the crew, not requiring any lighting. It's just a worst case scenario, a weak person with minimal technical skills in the dark in a smoke-filled cabin being able to open that door in a matter of seconds. So that's a threshold that door has to meet. And a downside of that is that anyone can open the door. It's very easy to do. The case what we have here is just someone just emotionally unattached, just decided they were uncomfortable and they wanted to get out of the airplane.
Right. There's a caveat to this, though, about just how easy that door is to open. It all depends on where the plane is, right?
Well, that's very true. The worst case scenario is to have opening the door at altitude where there'd be its tremendous depressurization. And one reason, in order to prevent that from happening, the door is designed so that the internal air pressure from the cabin actually assists in sealing the door.
Right.
in fact, at a normal cruise altitude under normal pressurization, it's physically impossible to open the door to overcome that pressurization differential to open the door. In this particular case, however, the airplane was descending about ready to land at about 700 feet. So the cabin was essentially depressurized. There was a minimum amount of pressurization holding that door shut. So in this case, he was able to, with his own muscle, be able to override that pressure.
Right. So listeners know that if you're in mid-flight, I mean, it's something like you need to be able to lift 20,000 pounds to open the door. That's how much the pressure keeps it sealed. But when, as you're landing, and as you're right, as it depressurizes, then the whole ease of opening that door that's meant to be in case of emergency then kicks in, and someone like this can just, I gather, just sort of fling it open without too much effort. How much of a challenge would this be for pilots to land with the door open at that level? Because I gather the landing was already happening. But how much of a challenge at that point, if any?
Well, firstly, not that challenging, but there are a lot of other considerations. For example, the airplane's on, you know, a short final, about ready to land, and the pilots probably felt the depressurization. They certainly got indications in the cockpit that a left door had opened. They can't look back there. They can't see it. As far as they knew, you know, probably the most logical thing is that a bomb went off.
Right.
So they have a lot of administrative things, you know, other than just flying the airplane that they need to take care of. And so there's a lot going through their mind, you know, should they continue the landing or should they execute a go around and maybe do a controllability check in the air to notify company, to notify air traffic control, to notify by fire and rescue. All these things have, you know, are going through the pilot's mind and things they have to do before they land.
Right. Because they, you're right, they can't look back and see what's happening. I mean, I suppose they could ask someone, one of the flight crew, but they can't ask anyone. They can't know exactly what's happening behind them.
They can't know exactly what's happening. And even if they talk to the flight attendant, the flight attendants may or may not have a direct view of the area. And they, even if they can see it, they probably have no real idea of what just happened. So trying to gather the information would be a major challenge. That being said, the door opening in and of itself should not impact the flying qualities. The airplane should fly basically the same, maybe a little bit of shuddering vibration. It'll feel emergency exit slide was deployed, ripped off right away due to air pressure. If you look at the pictures of the airplane, the door itself opened and slid forward, creating a minimal amount of airflow disturbance over the tail. So again, maybe the airplane may have felt like it was vibrating a little bit, but it would have flown almost as if it were perfectly normal.
It was interesting to see. I mean, I think a lot of people have seen that video by now. I mean, looking at it, the fact that only about a dozen passengers suffered some minor injuries was actually a narrow escape. You look at it and think, what if someone had been sucked out? I mean, there's all things that go through your mind if you're not an expert at this stuff.
Yes, exactly. And that's one reason why it's nice you want to have your seatbelt strapped around you,
right,
even during normal flight, because these weird things can happen. You know, everyone was fine. There was obviously a lot of wind blast. Probably a few people came close to having a heart attack just from the excitement. But, you know, having airplane doors and windows open in flight is not that unusual, especially in smaller airplanes. That's exactly what happens. It gets real cold, it gets real noisy, it gets real windy, and it gets real scary, but it really does not increase the danger significantly.
Yeah, we saw an incident, I think, that you were interviewed about a little earlier in the year where someone tried to open a door in mid-flight, which didn't happen. But it feels like, if you look at, maybe we're hearing more about it these days, but it feels like we're seeing more of these kinds of incidents on air. I mean, this is happening everywhere. People are dealing with people with mental distress and some mental health distress. But it feels like there's a new set of challenges here. Or maybe there isn't. Maybe we're just seeing, you know what it's like in the news media. When one thing happens, we see it again, right?
Yes. Well, just the fact that we've had a few of these and the news media has raised their antennas and they might report these more frequently. But on the other hand, I think this is generally just a trend we're seeing in our society. You know, less mental health facilities, mental health programs. It's more difficult to put people under conservatorship. So there's more people out there walking the streets that have real mental health issues. And in addition, post-COVID, a lot of people got really tight and upset about wearing masks on airplanes. So there's been a hostility toward flight crews and cabin crews. People are more belligerent against cabin crews, and they may, you know, that may extend into being having disciplinary problems and opening doors in flight, things of that nature. So I think it's kind of a general societal trend that's going on.
Yeah. I was reading somewhere earlier, and this was about, you know, an adjacent issue about there being no such thing as travel etiquette anymore. And you forget when you're riding in a metal tube together, you know, at altitude, just how much you have to all get along, right? How important it is to have, you know, that sense of responsibility for as each passenger. And when you start to see people getting more and more belligerent, it starts to call a bit of that into question when one person seems to be willing to sacrifice the safety of others because they're in a bad mood or they've, you know, lost the plot.
Well, that's very true. And I think the travel etiquette is becoming a lost art. On the other hand, there are many people, I like to include myself, that try to go the extra mile. You know, when I get on the airplane and off, I make the specific attempt to go thank the flight attendants for their work. I'll poke my head in the cockpit and say thanks to the men or women flying the airplane. And I would never ever consider arguing with either a cabin attendant or a flight crew. For me, that's just off limits. You know, if they tell me to do something, I do it, maybe ask questions later, but you know, arguing with one of those people is just the wrong way to go, and always be really nice to them.
Yeah. A good reminder now that everyone's sort of, you know, we're seeing huge returns to air travel this summer, particularly that, you know, again, that there's a very fine line when it comes to that etiquette and that social cohesion on airplanes. And if we start to forget it, it turns, I mean, I've seen some incidents over the years, especially involving alcohol, it starts to turn pretty nasty in those little spots.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
The Korean Airlines, Asian Airlines, was, I think, has now prevented for at least temporarily have stopped the sale of emergency exit seats on certain planes. Does that seem like, I guess that'll be something temporary, but I guess in this case, just a way of making sure this doesn't happen again.
I had not heard that. That's kind of an unusual move. Yeah. I'm not sure how effective that would be. I mean,
and counterproductive maybe in an emergency.
Yeah, I mean, people always have access to that door. They're walking up and down the aisle, you know, just because you're not seated next to one. I think that would not make a whole lot of difference.
Any lessons to walk away from this one? Again, it was a really scary looking incident. I gather, you know, because it was captured on camera phone, people saw around the world saw it. But there must be lessons in your eyes, at least lessons to walk away. Once again, luckily no one was badly hurt here. He could face up to 10 years in prison, the person allegedly responsible. But what would you walk away from just as, you know, the air flying public and all those who work on it with the airlines?
Not a whole lot. You know, from now on, I'm probably going to be looking at the people who are sitting next to the emergency exit doors and just make a quick, you know, assessment as best I could, obviously very limited, but just if I see someone really, really unusual, I may notify a flight attendant because, you know, the flight attendants are just too busy doing with their other regular duties. I might take the time to, you know, to look at someone, see if they look like they're really in trouble or really should not be there. Other than that, anytime I fly, I specifically pick an emergency exit row.
Oh, really?
Next to it. Yeah, because that'd be the fastest, you know, just a matter of survival. That'd be the fastest way out of the airplane, you know, if it did catch on fire. So I intentionally try to sit there. In addition, anytime I get on an airplane, even though it's the same airplane that I fly, I'll still pull out the emergency instruction card,
right,
and I'll review it. And I'll make sure I know how to open that particular door or that particular window exit, because all the airplanes are different. They don't all have the same kind of doors or latches. Some require manual inflation of the slide. Some do not. So there's always something to look at, and just to make sure that I'm familiar with how to open that particular door or window that I'm sitting next to.
Yeah, I'm sure many people with much less experience with the plane than you have completely ignore that every time they sit down. It's good advice. Doug Moss, thank you so much.
You're welcome. My pleasure.
Hi, it's Shauna, and I might be a bad parent because my kids think french fries are vegetables.
Hey, it's Ryan, and I might be a bad parent because I went out for wings when my wife was in the hospital after giving birth.
Johnny here. I might be a bad parent because in my house, the tooth fairy gives pocket change.
But we're not alone. Len emailed us and said his six-year-old daughter's Tarzan moment going from love seat to lazy boy by curtains made him more proud than any dance recital.
And Andy left his two-year-old at the rink. All right, guys, I'm sure we're not alone. Like Andy's kid.
For stories and confessions like this, make sure you check out our podcast.
It's called Bad Parents, and it's available wherever you get your podcasts.
I left a glove at the rink.